Chapter 28, Miracle on Ice. We made it to Rockefeller Center as the setting sun was poking through the cloud cover and sending shafts of golden sunlight up the east-west facing streets. Before us, the RCA building cast an imposing shadow over Woolman Rink and also over another imposing landmark, the traditional 70-foot-tall Christmas tree being prepared for lighting in the coming days. The rink itself, recessed two stories below ground level, had 50 or 60 skaters circling the ice. Its once transparent surface was now scratched white and opaque from so many blade cuts. On the other side of the rink was the golden statue of Prometheus, flying sideways, like a skater who has tripped and is spread out in midair but has yet to come down. Christmas music wafted up from below. Ringside, it would have sounded natural, albeit probably too loud. But up where we were standing, the sound merged with its reflected echoes off the surrounding buildings, melding with the city's traffic sounds, and giving the music a distorted shimmering quality, like heat waves rising off a desert. It didn't by any means detract from its charm. I ask her, Would you care to skate? How can we? Look at the line. We'll never get on. Well, let's try anyway. Maybe the line will move faster than we think. As soon as we found the end of it, the skating music stopped. They cleared the skaters off the ice to allow the Zamboni to come out and groom the surface. Audrey was craning her neck, looking up at the tall buildings. I said, "Can you believe this place used to be an apple orchard with a bunch of cows grazing on it?" "It did?" "Way back when, the land was known as Hossett Gardens. It was given to Columbia in 1814 as a site for a new campus when the old one, located on the southern tip of Manhattan, became too crowded. Trouble was, by the time the college got around to moving, it wasn't rural here anymore. So the school hopscotched all the way up to Morningside Heights, where everyone believed the metropolis could never extend. It did, though, quite quickly. As I was speaking, a handsome tuxedoed Prince Charming type came up the steps from below and began walking down the line, selecting couples at random. He was wearing his skates and walking on his skate guards, which made him appear extra tall. He came down the line, and when he got to us, he stopped, bent at the waist, and presented his arm to Audrey. With a suave French accent, he said, "Mademoiselle, please to be my partner for the first dance." She answered, "Oh, no, thank you. I couldn't. I can't. I'm not a very good skater." "Not to worry. I will make you look like a pro. I promise," I said. "Go ahead. I'll watch you from up here." She protested and tried to say no again, but I encouraged her. "Go ahead. Why not?" he said. "And then your boyfriend can join us after the first dance, hmm?" He placed her hand on his forearm and held it there with his other hand while gently urging her forward. Others in the line were encouraging her, too. I added a little push from behind, and so, reluctantly, she gave in. As she accompanied him, she looked back at me, half jokingly, half seriously, pleading, "Save me!" He escorted her down to the benches, then knelt and helped her put on a pair of skates, and then laced them up for her. When that was done, her drab winter coat was exchanged for a stylish pink one, with a fluffy white collar, fuzzy white cuffs, and a matching hat, very Dr. Zhivago-like. As the other couples were held back, Prince Charming led a wobbly Audrey Hopkins out to center ice. with one arm around her waist and the other holding her upper arm. He assumed the startup position. She was teetering, just standing there. As the beautiful waltz music began, he started them off, his long rhythmic glides perfectly in time to the music. She relied on him totally. At first she tried to keep up with little running steps, but then her knees locked and she took no steps at all. Prince Charming, however, was keeping his promise to make her look good. Without seeming to do so, he supported all her weight, so her blades barely touched the ice, allowing her to get the feel of the motion and the rhythm. Gradually, as she progressed, he gave her more and more control, but was always ready to seize it back again if she faltered, which she did repeatedly. However, by the third revolution, it was obvious she was really getting the hang of it. The crowd noticed and applauded. Rosy-cheeked and beaming, Audrey sought me out and waved. I waved back, and just as I did, I felt a sharp poke in my ribs. I turned around to see Hugh Blackwell smiling benevolently, a Cheshire grin on his face. He said,
"It worked, didn't it? She's enjoying it."
"Oh, Mr. Blackwell, this is just great. This is fantastic. Much more than I expected.
As soon as she steps off the ice, she'll be handed a dozen roses. She gets to keep the coat and the hat, too. Look, I've got to go."
He offered me his hand, and I shook it. Then he began walking back to his limousine, so I went with him.
"Mr. Blackwell, really, thanks a million."
No thanking me. I'm just glad we could arrange something."
As we approached his vehicle, his chauffeur timed the opening of the door so that Blackwell could bend and enter without slackening pace, much the same way the circus trainer does when he times the opening of the cage door so the lion can leap in on the run. The vacuum door locks engaged. The rear curbside window ghosted down again. Hugh Blackwell's face reappeared.
"Now I still want to hear from you about that other matter."
"Don't worry, you will."
"Promise?"
"I do."
"All right."
He gave the signal to the driver. The sleek limousine pulled away, a shiny blob of black mercury merging into traffic.